It is February 10th, and this is the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. Just a reminder, the opinions and thoughts I express on this podcast are mine and don't represent those of my employer. Wow, there's been a lot of things happening out in the security industry since I've last recorded a podcast. I've tried to go through and pick out the ones that are most interesting, at least to me, and I think have some interesting lessons to learn. First, though, is just a completely trivial story, which is that the ISD podcast shut down last week. I think they made it to episode 839, which is really quite an accomplishment. I just don't know how those guys did a daily show for so long. I will say that show was probably one of the things that inspired me to start this podcast. And as you probably know, I do a podcast at most once a week, and it's really tough. It's difficult to find the time to dedicate to come up with things to talk about. It's difficult to dedicate the time to actually sit down and record. And at least for me, I don't get this done in one shot. So my hat's off to them, and I definitely appreciated listening to them for a number of years, and now I have to find some other nonsense to listen to in the gym every morning. All right, moving on. I've noticed a fairly significant uptick in phishing attacks against me and coworkers, family. Definitely doesn't appear to be targeted to any organization. Seems to be coming from lots of different compromised and fake or bogus created accounts on different mail services. From what I looked at, most of the links and whatnot tend to go to different exploit kits that have anti-analysis techniques built into them, where unless they see certain strings in the browser field, they don't return what you would expect, or they don't return the exploit. So something is very likely behind that. Either a new botnet is emerging, or people are finding new ways of monetizing that, and that's driving some additional activity. All right, moving on. I want to talk about the Java update. Probably the most funny thing I heard about this on Twitter was a one-liner that said that Oracle had released an updated installer for the Ask toolbar, which included some security fixes for Java. Seriously, though, it is interesting that they released a new version so fast after the last one. Oracle has a fairly bad reputation for releasing patches in a timely manner, so it was good to see that they might be getting with the program. All right, next story is about CombofX. And for those that aren't aware, CombofX is a fairly common piece of free anti-malware used to remove some of the more complicated rootkits and whatnot. Apparently, the author of CombofX was playing with a variant of Sality on his system and recompiled a version of CombofX and posted it up to his website. And sure enough, your version of CombofX came with a free version of Sality for a limited time only. Obviously, that's not great. The author acted pretty responsibly, took it down as soon as he was alerted to it. The problem there is that CombofX, among many, many, many other freeware and shareware programs, gets repackaged by lots of different websites. You know, HipFileHippo and download.com and so many others. The challenge there is that those sites don't really coordinate with the author of those tools. So, you know, who really knows which of those sites might have downloaded CombofX while it was infected and packaged it up and are offering it for download. And that's the problem with those sites, is they don't coordinate with the author of the tools that they are repackaging. So, you know, definitely be wary of those. And I strongly recommend that you dissuade people from using those. All right, next thing I want to talk about is the Cisco 2013 security report. This was fairly interesting. I think a lot of news was made. There's some fairly interesting claims that legitimate sites are far more likely to be malicious than what we typically think of as malicious sites, such as pornography. So the oft-stated statistic was that ad networks were 823 times more likely to deliver a malicious web page than a porn site. Hopefully that really isn't surprising to most people. Now, keeping in mind that attackers more and more are really driven by money, right? So they want to go where the people are. It used to be that they needed to stick to the dark corners of the internet where they could get shady website operators to cooperate with them. But now it's much easier to compromise an ad network or come up with some type of malicious ad that gets played on legitimate ad networks. Next up is a story about Anonymous stealing the information of 4,600 bank executives from a Federal Reserve website. Apparently, this was an application the Fed was using in the event of an emergency where they need to contact different banks to facilitate the transfer of funds and keep our financial system running. So the data that was released had names, emails, hashed passwords and phone numbers, that sort of thing. Not hard to think what kinds of damage that information like that on 4,600 executives at banks might be able to do. Think of the possibility of spear phishing and those sorts of things. Let alone that those hashed passwords are probably in use lots of other places. It's interesting that the Fed seems to be trying to downplay the importance of what was taken, and Anonymous seems to be trying to stick their thumb in the Fed's eye, saying, you know, that that's not all we have. We have more. And I've seen directory listings being posted. So not really sure where this one's going to end, but certainly something to watch. Next up is another Anonymous hack of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. The U.S. Sentencing Commission website was hacked in response to the suicide of Aaron Swartz. Aaron Swartz was, as I'm sure everybody knows, being dogged by federal prosecutors for some things he did at MIT. Whether or not you agree, the site was taken down and defaced with the normal Anonymous flair and diatribe. But the administrators apparently took it down, took it offline. I think they just removed DNS records, put it back online, and a number of hours later, it was defaced again. And this time it was defaced with a version of Asteroids that was mocking them. So what's interesting to me in this one is not that the site was actually defaced. That happens all the time. It's that the site was defaced, taken offline, and apparently restored and put back into service. You know, I can only assume that there was really no analysis done to figure out how these people got in, and the order of the day was just to get the site back up and running as fast as possible so that they didn't look bad and tried to minimize the public image of Anonymous hurting them. So that to me says there's a really fine balance between availability and trying to understand the root of a system that's compromised. Generally, if a system is compromised, especially a web server sitting out on the internet, you don't want to put it back out there until you understood how it was compromised and you make sure that it was fixed. Otherwise, it's just going to happen again and you're going to look twice as dumb. And oh boy, the next one is a whopper. The New York Times announces it was hacked by China. So allegedly for 4 months, the Chinese government or Chinese government-sponsored hackers or somebody who has a Chinese server was hacking the New York Times. Apparently, this was in response to a New York Times article where a reporter in China had blown a story about the ruling family having profited pretty handsomely off of the position of power to the tune of billions of dollars. And in a communist country where people are supposed to be more or less equal, you could kind of see how that might be touchy. So the assertion is that the Chinese government was trying to figure out where the leak came from, so I'm sure they could go and speak to that person about how important it is to keep state secrets secret. So back to the actual New York Times incident. The NYT contracted Mandiant, and Mandiant is a, as we all know, very astute at tracking down Chinese attackers. Allegedly, the attacks were being routed through compromised systems at some undisclosed U.S. universities. The apparent method of entry into the NYT was spear phishing. That seems to be a fairly common thing these days. There were 45 pieces of malware, only one of which their AV vendor caught, as reported by the NYT. Interestingly, Symantec lashed out at that and said, to paraphrase, "Of course it got through. Of course you were hacked. You weren't using all of our products." That's not really what they said, but that's kind of how it's being interpreted. You know, the reality is, in a targeted attack, the attacker is going to intentionally craft a malware that isn't detected by the antivirus that their adversary is using. It would be absolutely pointless if I wanted to attack the NYT that I would just package up poison ivy and ship it to them in an email, because very likely it's going to get caught. No, I'm going to figure out how to package that damn thing so it doesn't get caught by their antivirus. I'm going to do my homework and find out that they are using Symantec, and I'm going to play with that until I get it so it's not detected. You know, it's not magic, people. And this is really one of those times when whitelisting comes into play, right? And I've got an interesting story about whitelisting coming up. So, you know, the story itself was coming under quite a lot of fire. You know, there's some funny references to rainbow tables, which obviously shows the person who wrote the article isn't a longtime security pro and latched onto some discussions that he or she probably heard some of the investigators talking about rainbow tables and other things, and latched onto it and just really didn't have a full grasp on it. Another criticism is that Mandiant's involvement is interesting because Mandiant sees China everywhere they look. But you know, the reality is that Mandiant does do this a lot, and you know, we don't have all of the details. So, you know, without that, we don't know for sure that it wasn't China. And in fact, I would say You know, Mandiant probably does have a lot of experience there that, you know, the average person doesn't. So I'm not sure that is warranted criticism. Another thing people are really banging on is that there's just a lack of details. So how can we know it was China if you're not providing details? Well, you know, the reality is it's, I'd say, pretty interesting that they reported it at all. Most organizations wouldn't do what they did. So I'm not sure what people think they're going to get, right? You're not going to get logs and really excruciating details like you might get from some public entity being breached where they're obligated to disclose details. In the last criticism, which I think is fair, that the article really portrays this as a very technologically sophisticated attack and something that really has to be pulled off by an advanced entity, well-funded and organized like the Chinese government. But the reality is no component of this was all that sophisticated, and in fact a competent pen tester could probably pull this off pretty easily. Now, having said that, you know, I think there probably are some earmarks that do show this very likely did come from China, but, you know, we'll never know for sure. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think a lot of that is just crap. I think the government tends to have a hard time keeping anything secret, as we've seen time and time again. But, you know, I'll just kind of leave this here. I find it really interesting that the U.S. government is really trying very hard to wring out who the source of the Stuxnet leak was. And that Stuxnet leak was leaked to a reporter at the New York Times. And if I wanted to hack a media organization and make it look like somebody else did it, I'd sure as heck do it from China with some Chinese written malware that we had collected. I'm just saying. So next, Wall Street Journal is doing the Me Too, Me Too. I was hacked by China too. Except there's really no details about the incident. Apparently they were notified by the FBI that they had seen some data crossing the wire somewhere from its Beijing office. And they were also claiming that the attackers in China were trying to uncover some details about coverage of their Chinese operation. Okay, moving on. Next is a update from the State of South Carolina Department of Revenue breach from a couple of months back. There's an interesting war of words developing between the actual Department of Revenue and a former information security manager. The information security manager is publicly saying that indeed had they've been looking, it's almost certain that someone would have noticed the intruder before any data was stolen. And he asserts that nobody was looking at the logs. See, he was terminated fairly soon before the breach occurred. So now there's a back and forth. Yes, we were looking at logs. No, you're not looking at logs, but apparently now they are indeed looking at logs every day. So I would say, despite the Department of Revenue's statement saying that Mandiant assured them that this attack was technologically sophisticated and would not be recognizable by looking at logs, now they're looking at logs every day. So I'll let you be the judge there. I think the lesson here is that if you have the right instrumentation on your systems and on your network, you know, no matter how sophisticated the attackers are, you're probably going to see some kind of evidence of something happening. So it comes down to the sensitivity and what you're willing to pay to keep your stuff safe. You really have to tailor those kinds of things to your environment. And if you do, you will very often see evidence of sophisticated attacks. You might see it being presented in a way that doesn't make sense, and that in the end leads you through a very complex investigation. But nonetheless, you have the data that you need. And the final story is a story about supply chain security. And my gosh, that sounds really boring. But here's the story. A vendor of a piece of security software is breached. And the attackers that breach that vendor aren't really targeting the vendor. They want to target the vendor's customers because, well, the vendor's product is pretty effective and they need help. So that appears to be what happened with Bit9. Bit9 is an application whitelisting software provider. And a couple of days ago, Brian Krebs, the ever-vigilant guy that he is, discovered that apparently malware was being signed with a legitimate certificate issued to Bit9. That's really concerning because that certificate is indeed what Bit9's whitelisting engine determines or uses to determine whether or not a piece of software is acceptable or should be blocked. Now, you know, I think there's two interesting things to this story to me. Number one is the raw security aspect. You know, we have a situation where a supply chain vendor is inducing risk onto its customers, and that vendor is in fact charged with reducing that risk. And so it's fairly complicated that, you know, you really have to, as an organization, take that into account. You know, what were to happen if my antivirus vendor screws up? And that screw up can happen in lots of different ways. It can take your systems down. It can cause blue screens. It can let viruses come through. It can come packaged with a virus. It can have a signing certificate stolen. Lots and lots of different opportunities there that you need to think about. The second interesting area to me has to do with what the CEO says was behind the certificate being stolen. He basically says, and I put the quote in the show notes, that this was due to an operational oversight where they had failed to install their Bit9 product on a handful of computers on their network. Well, you can kind of think that the servers that they were compromised happened to be the ones that had access to or had the signing certificate on it and able to be stolen. So not terribly difficult to think that, you know, those are probably some fairly important servers, or at least they were in conjunction with or on the same Active Directory domain as some systems that that did have that. It really highlights to me the importance of configuration management and ensuring that you don't have systems on your network that aren't configured to your security standards. You know, we don't know for certain what exactly happened in this case, but, you know, we kind of have to take them at their word. And it's not hard to think that these kinds of things happen all the time where somebody stands up a server, they're trying to do something fast and dirty and really just circumvent the process. and that circumvention happens to leave it exposed in some manner, and you know that allows an attacker into the network, and now you have a PR nightmare on your hands. So the next interesting thing on the story is that Bit9 has been a fairly big detractor of antivirus. You know, given the area that they play in, they really have to throw a lot of stones to get people to pay attention to them. And by the way, I think application whitelisting is actually a very good technology and really should be a layer of defense in an organization. Now, I'm not going to give a commercial for Bit9, but you know, that sort of thing I definitely think has a place. I don't want, and I hope people don't, interpret this incident as a referendum on application whitelisting versus antivirus. But anyway, back on point, Bit9 is getting their comeuppance, right? So AV vendors are now starting to come out and say, you know, hey, look, Bit9 has the same flaws that we all do. Isn't that interesting? So I put a link to Sophos' article in there. I thought it was a pretty well-written thumb in the eye of Bit9. And so that will do it for this week. I definitely appreciate everyone listening. I hope this was useful to you. Again, if you have any feedback or comments, please send me a note at podcast@defensivesecurity.org. Definitely like getting notes about how I'm doing. And I definitely will be talking to you next week. I'm really going to try hard to get this out more regularly. With that, have a great week, and I will talk to you again next weekend. Bye.